This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Tessa Vigeland. And here's a decision for you. Imagine you're a Hollywood star and presumably rather well compensated. But with your downtime, you could take a fancy vacation, maybe work on a film or a play. Hill Harper takes a different path. He is a star of the TV crime show CSI New York, but in his off hours, he has written 4 books, including one on personal finance called The Wealth Cure. And he joins me now in studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, I know this is the paperback issue of a book that came out quite a while ago, but I have to ask you, why does someone like you take an interest in telling people about personal finance?
Well, you know, it's funny. I went to Brown undergrad and before I went to Harvard for grad school, and I studied economics and sociology, and I was always interested in the way money and the way we live, how those two things link. And I think that as I've been working with through my foundation and all the people I come into contact with, the more I talk about what people care about, it's money. What stresses people out? Money. What's the number one thing that people argue about in terms of their relationships? Money. And so money occupies this huge space in many of our lives, most of our lives, yet many of us have an unhealthy relationship to money. And I wanted to really explore that, and I include myself in that. It's not that I'm the expert. What I am is the explorer, hopefully with the reader, exploring this unhealthy relationship to money and wealth.
What is your relationship to it?
Well, hopefully it's better after writing a book called The Wealth Cure, because people hear the title, they say, The Wealth Cure? I don't want my wealth cured. I want my wealth injected, you know. So, you know, this idea of curing an unhealthy relationship to money is something that is very fundamental. You know, you look at a lot of personal finance books. You can take a Susie Orman book or a Dave Ramsey book and a number of books that we could mention. Wonderful books. But many of them make you feel guilty about spending a dollar. Many of them tell you all these things that you should do that are, you know, relatively commonsensical, yet most of us don't do it.
Right.
I kind of put finance money books and diet books kind of in the same category. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that if you burn more calories than you take in, you will lose weight.
Right.
I mean, that's really what, you know, right. All diet books out there could just be distilled into that one fact, right?
If you save more than you spend.
If you save more than you spend, you will collect or save money. So, right. But there's something bigger. There's a bigger thing that I wanted to explore in this. Why don't we do it? Why do we carry so much debt? Why are we living in an unhealthy lifestyle where we have diabetes, blood pressure, heart disease, all these issues that are regarding obesity? My book is about the marriage of health and wealth and overall well-being in terms of your life and coming up with a healthier relationship to money. That's why it's called The Wealth Cure.
Well, let's talk about the wealth virus,
yes.
Which is not the part of health and wealth that we want. So what did you mean by that when you talk in the book about this wealth virus?
Well, what I meant by that is that most of us have been taught the wrong thing about money. Most of us have been taught, first of all, that money is a result, not that money is what it really is. It's an actual tool to be used to create the life, the world, the community, the family, et cetera, that we want. It's a tool. And so what happens is when we're taught that it's a result, we're chasing something that's a false positive, really. And then what happens, you have all these pop culture influences and sociological influences that come in and sort of start leading you down this road of chasing something that really isn't what it is purported to be, which – so it's a virus. It becomes a virus. Like, I start wanting it and needing it and wanting more and I need more. And since it's false, in other words, you're attempting to use something as a result to fill a hole, you want more and more. It's almost like an addiction, a viral addiction. So you need more money. Many of my friends that I went to Harvard with, as a straight example of this, went to Harvard Law School with. They came out, got high-paying legal jobs, and many of them will tell you that they're miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they tell you that they can't leave that job. Why? Because they need the income to support the lifestyle that they actually have created based on the unhappiness quotient of their job. In other words, they were attempting to buy happiness. They're saying, I'm making a lot of money, so I'm going to buy these things that I really don't love, the car, the house, this, that, and the other. I'm buying them because I think I should like them because I've been told that that's the reason I'm working this job.
But You know, I think when people of modest means hear that, and that is an argument that is made a lot. And I think there was a study recently that showed that I think it's, you know, any amount of money above 70, like 70,000 or something like that, that it doesn't create any more happiness for you. But, you know, people on the lower end of the income scale, I think, would just laugh at that and say, you know what, my life would be a lot better. I would be a heck of a lot happier if I had more money.
My foundation, Manifest Your Destiny Foundation, our focus is to work with folks who are from communities with lesser means. And what you find is that most of us really fundamentally, once we break it down, have very similar what I call wealth factors in the book. We have to be honest about what truly makes us wealthy. Is it that car, or is it actually the love of our children, grandchildren, et cetera? Is it the time we spend? Not all things are created equal, just like money is not created equal. For instance, there's smart money and there's dumb money. And so when someone who is earning less or has less means, in other words, they're spending a higher percentage of their income on essentials versus discretionary items, lifestyle items. That's really what it comes down to when you're talking about the need to spend higher percentages of your income on essentials. We all need to eat food. We all need shelter. Okay, so we're talking about essential items. You spend a higher percentage, the less money you earn.
Right.
Okay, so those people still have to value and use money in a similar way, yet it's a smaller percentage of their income that they're using on discretionary items, and they even become bigger victims of what I call the lotto mentality, which is a regressive tax, which is the idea that, you know what, if I chase more money, then I'll actually yield more discretionary income, which leads me to buy more happiness, rather than let's flip it, and we all can do this, saying I'm going to value my life account higher than my bank account, and the bank account will ultimately follow if I build it this way.
You actually made what turned out to be a fairly risky investment in online advertising, and it ultimately did not quite work out as well as I'm sure you had hoped.
Thanks for reminding me.
Yes, $350,000, as you talk about in the book. How did that affect you going forward, and how does that inform how you talk about wealth and the spending of it in the book?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that we all have choices of what we do with whatever money we have, whether it's large amounts, small amounts, et cetera. And for me, the way I took a step back from it was to say, you know what, it's not about being risk-averse or non-risk-averse. It's about saying, okay, if this pays off, if this particular investment actually comes to fruition, wherever they're predicting the investment is going to pay back, what value is that going to add to my life in what areas? And then I can be much more specific about whether I want to place that investment. Is that investment actually valuable enough to me for this particular risk quotient? So it's literally like a doctor, and what I talk about is a doctor coming up with a diagnosis for a particular patient. There are many different ways to treat a number of ills. Okay, you can come out through surgery, you can come out with non-invasive procedures, you can do this, you can do that. But we have to come up with an idea as to what result do we want to have on the back side of that. I have a number of friends that have been sick. Myself, I was diagnosed with cancer. You make a decision based on the life you want to live after. You know, if you don't want to live this particular way because the result of the procedure would have you living a certain life, then maybe you choose not to do that particular procedure. And the same thing goes with investment. But there are other people who are in a place in their life where they want to take a little more risk. They actually get a charge, or they enjoy the risk. And if you get an enjoyment out of that risk, you're an entrepreneurial spirit, and you know, most of our entrepreneurs, as we know, have failed several times before that successful business happens. If you're the person who enjoys that, then go for that. There's nothing wrong with spending your money in that risky way. And no one should judge you, but you have to be clear for yourself. Come up with your own diagnosis, your own blueprint that's very specific to what your wealth factors are, and then maximize your wealth factors.
So how would you diagnose how you made that decision to do that and how it went?
Well, for me, what happened is that as I was looking at it, what I was thinking about was as an actor, my career, my income side of the ball. Well, it's much like an athlete. There's sometimes when you're up and you're a high earner, and then if you're out of work, you're not. So if I could find that one investment that would actually smooth that out, that gives me a big hit, a high income hit, and then I could actually be an artist. I could pick and choose the type of projects I want to do. I could do Broadway for $300 a week and not worry about paying my mortgage, those types of things. So you can see already I have a flawed process, already a flawed process, rather than saying this, what do I love doing? If it's Broadway, $300 a week or whatever, then let's set that up and then figure out what type of lifestyle I need to live and what type of money I need to have or not have to actually live that life on $300 a week. And then invest my money or use it however I want, but not chase the money to buy the life. It's actually live the life and then find and be very clear about how much money I need to support it. It's actually life account versus bank account.
But I think a lot of people would look at that and say, well, there is a lot of risk to take. I mean,
yes.
if you are following what you really want to do and trusting
yes.
that somehow you will be able to make that work, sometimes that's just a wish and a prayer, isn't it?
No. It's about this. It's about investing. But in this case, investing in yourself.
Hmm.
Now, there's people out there that are listening to us have this conversation right now that want to quit their jobs today. They're miserable. Okay, they're listening and they'd love to walk into the office. Now, not suggesting that in the least. What you want to do, though, is actually invest in yourself and say, what do I really love and enjoy? And then, therefore, what training, what new education, what new things do I have to invest in to position myself to make this transition to a new place or a new job in my life? And so it's really thinking about in terms of investment. Do I want to invest $350 in a startup, or do I want to invest $3,500? Let's just do $3,500 in this little internet startup or in this stock. Or do I want to invest $3,500 in this computer training program because I'd actually want to develop technologies, or I love gaming and I want to get into the gaming area. And I'm going to keep my job so I can continue to invest in myself because I want that income. And then a year from now, 18 months from now, when I've gained this training and I've also developed relationships through networking and a mastermind circle and other things I talk about in the book, my book, The Wealth Cure, if we gain those things, I can make that transition and I've invested in myself and I've also moved out of where I'm stuck. I'm hoping this is making sense. It's not a wing and a prayer. It's actually calculated. I talk about this idea of being an active architect of your own life. Most of us will require more specificity from an architect we hire to build a home, i.e. we want to see a blueprint. We'd never hire an architect that says, I got you. I'll just build it the way you say you want three bedrooms and three baths. I got you. No, I want to see the blueprint. Okay, we'll ask for more specificity from that architect than we ask of our own selves in building our lives. And that's a shame because most of us look back at some point and say, if I was just a little bit more specific, if I had a little bit clearer methodology about building my life, I could have built a wealthier life, a happier life.
You say in the book that it's actually an exercise in courage to save money. What do you mean by that?
Yes, because ultimately you're not buying into societal forces. You're not buying into those things that actually push you. You know, there are so many pressures and pushes to run up debt. To use your credit card in instances and situations where you shouldn't and you don't need to actually carry debt month to month, to have a higher car note than you need. You know, I'm very clear about – I have a debt rule. I believe that the debt is only allowed in two cases in your life, investing yourself in terms of education, training, et cetera, or investment in terms of real property ownership.
Mm-hmm. A mortgage.
And mortgage and or investment property. Okay. I believe outside of those areas or investment in business, you know, in other words, a small business loan or what have you, outside of those areas, see, those are that's investment debt. Outside of that area, the debt's not allowed. I don't believe in carrying – I believe in not having a car note. And if you're in a situation – and people hate hearing this. My first car was $300 Corolla with rusted out bottom that had, I think, 350,000 miles on it. You know, that was my first, you know, the car that I drove in college. And it wasn't a glamorous car by any stretch. And there, and granted, there weren't a lot of girls that were excited to date me, seeing me in this car. But you know, hopefully they were betting on my potential and not thinking about the fact that I was going to make a really bad investment later on in life. But here's the deal. I bought a car that I could afford. I used to have a pastor that said, you know what? I see too many of these luxury cars out in the thing. I want you all to buy a car you can afford. And when I say afford, I mean afford.
So, i.e. a Taurus.
That's right. Buy American, which is great. But either pay cash and buy a used car or find a way. Do not go into debt for a vehicle. It's a depreciating asset. It's dumb money. It's dumb money spending. I'm a big believer in not all dollars are created equally. There's smart dollars and dumb dollars. Too many of us are spending too much of our money on dumb dollars, and I don't care what your income level is, whether it's your minimum wage earner or your maximum wage earner. Most of us spend most of our money on dumb money and not smart money.
You stop the book after you talk about how your cancer surgery was successful. But I'm curious if there are—
If it wasn't, I wouldn't be talking to you right
well,
now.
Well, indeed. I'm curious whether you had other epiphanies about money, about wealth, after that experience.
Yeah, you know, what's so amazing is that when I think about money and I think about this idea that money is this tool, everything in our lives, everything in this society, in our family, everything we get bombarded with on a daily basis is telling us that money's a result. Money is that thing to chase, rather than what it really is, which is simply a tool just like a hammer. And a hammer is awesome when you have to pound nails. It's a great tool, right? Super effective. But it's not so good if you need to use it to clean your wood floor. If you use it to the head of a hammer to clean your floor, you actually do more destruction and damage than good. So money's the exact same way. Money, when it's used properly in our lives, when we have a healthy relationship to it and we know why we're using it, we have a plan for it, and we use it very specifically, it's an amazing tool that can foster a happier, healthier, wealthier life. If we use it in ways that we're trying to fill other holes, whether they be self-esteem, societal, all sorts of other things, we're chasing something that we think we should have or go for, or we deserve, etc., then it's actually destructive in our lives, and we end up living lives that are smaller than we were meant to live. Don't let money and the chase of it send you down that road. And that's what the Wealth Cure is all about. It's curing that chase, that false positive chase that we talked about in the very beginning of this conversation.
I don't like asking this question, but I feel like I have to because okay. I have a feeling that you know, there will be people who hear this and wonder why they should be taking advice about money, not the management of it, but just about money itself, from someone who has a lot of it and who has been able to make it through means that some people might discount as, you know, just it's Hollywood money. You have been lucky enough, talented enough to be on a hit TV show for years.
Yes.
Presumably that has been kind to your bank accounts. Why should people who are struggling listen to what you have to say?
Well, because first of all, the whole idea of this book is an exploration of me saying that, you know what, I'm not a money expert. You know, I may make a significant amount, but I have messed up a lot with it. And at the end of the day, you know, I've fortunate enough to own a hotel in New Orleans and own properties and restaurants and other things like that, some of which have failed miserably, some of which have done quite well. At the end of the day, we're all in this journey together, and we all have different things that make us feel wealthy. And when you really strip people down and you really ask the question, and I did this with myself and I do it with friends, when you really ask the question, most of the stuff that makes us truly happy is not money related. And so if we're able to actually separate the two, because money is still extremely important, mm-hmm. It's a huge piece of all of our lives. And if you don't have a lot of it, but you want more of it, you can get it. But you can be much more judicious. You're going to have to be much more judicious about how you use that tool. And so for me, it's about exploring those ideas and those themes. That's what I've done in all my books. I'm never the expert. And I don't want people to think of me as that. I'm the person on the journey trying to figure it out. It's just like when I got diagnosed with cancer and I was writing this much more dense financial literacy book. It made me realize that none of that stuff matters unless you have your health. So let's figure that out first. I needed to figure out my health first. My father died of cancer. My grandfather died of cancer. If I didn't figure that out, none of it mattered at all.
Why is financial literacy important to you?
It's so important because it's the number one excuse that I hear when I ask people about their life and their dreams and their goals, and they tell me why they aren't living the life they want to live. By far. Money is the number one thing couples argue about. Money is the number one thing that people say causes them stress, their bills, their debt, etc. And it's also the number one thing that people say is what's keeping them from actually living the life they want to live. So if money is that number one thing, if it's that root cause of stopping you from living that life, stopping you from building communities the way you want to see them, stopping us from having the families, the schools, all of these things that we're hearing people talk about at these different conventions, all the politics, if money occupies that huge space, we need to deal with it in an honest way. Let's have a real conversation about it. Let's figure out why we have an unhealthy relationship to it, and let's get healthy. Let's have a wealth cure.
Why is this the one area where people have such trouble talking about it and dealing with it?
Because they're ashamed of it. It's amazing to me. It's amazing to me. The wonderful study came out recently that showed, watch this, that people are more apt to want to and willing to discuss affairs that they've had than how much they earn. They're more apt to discuss that than how much debt they carry. They're more apt to discuss that than how much they've saved over their life. So money is one of the closest, most personal guarded secrets. We have so much fear and shame around it because most of us think that we haven't earned enough. Most of us think that we don't have enough. Most of us, but we don't have no idea what other people have. That's what's amazing because no one tells you what they have. So everybody's operating from this idea that everybody else has a lot more than they do. And it's amazing. It's like even you ask the question, why should someone listen to you? You make so much more money. You don't know what I make.
That's
true. You don't know what I make.
That's
Nobody
true.
Knows.
Right.
And let's be quite honest. Yes, I'm on a show called CSI New York, but the real person making most of the money is Jerry Bruckheimer. Thank you very much. Not the actors. You know, we're still work for hire. Let's be very clear. And we're fungible property. There are other people that, and they know in their negotiation that there's plenty of other people that would take our jobs happily. So it's not like we have a great deal of leverage here. So no one wants to talk about money. And unless we really want to have honest conversations about it, and people can say, oh, that's common sense. If it's so common sense, how come nobody wants to talk about it and nobody wants to be honest about it? And everybody puts on airs, acting as if they have more than they do, and other people assume that other people have more than they do.
Hill Harper is the author of The Wealth Cure, Putting Money in Its Place. And you also may have caught him on a little series called CSI New York, where he plays Dr. Sheldon Hawks. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.